Starting here from the Mishnah at the bottom of Nuntet Amud Bet. Ein marvin perot biperot. One cannot mix fruits with fruits. Afilu chadashim bechadashim. Even new fruits with new fruits. Now, the way that Rashi interprets it is, you can't mix produce from different fields. Because produce from different fields has different qualities, different tastes, different flavors. So you shouldn't be mixing them from different fields. If you look in the Rosh and other Pirushim over here, they do not read it this way like Rashi. Mixing fruits from many fields is a normal way to sell produce or to present the produce. He said that they say this is more nefarious, which is that the individual is taking good quality produce and putting it on top. Underlying that produce is bad quality or other produce that's not up to the quality of the produce you're putting on top. Therefore, you're trying to deceive or cheat people by giving a look of really good quality, whereas the items that are found below are not as of good quality. That's the way that the Rosh reads it. And you don't have to tell me that in a case you shouldn't mix the new stuff with the old stuff. Now, the way Rashi explains this is that the old stuff is worth more because it's already dried out. Rashi is not speaking about peirot here, but rather about grain. When grain is already dried, it's much easier to mill, and the flour that comes out of it is a much better quality flour. So if you have older and drier grain, you shouldn't mix in newer and moist grain, because the person who's buying it from you is trying to buy the dry stuff, which is the higher quality stuff. If you mix in the chadashim, the newer stuff, then you're giving him stuff that's not worth what he's paying for. He's paying for the higher price dry stuff, and you're putting in the lower price newer stuff, which would be cheating him, because that's not what he thinks he is buying over here. Be'emet amru, truthfully they say, and the Gemara will discuss what that means, be'yayin hitiru, by wine they made it mutar, larev kasheh berach, to mix hard wine with soft wine. Obviously, wine is not hard and soft, but I would say kasheh means more pungent or strong wine versus rach, which is grape juice, but wine in the beginning or before it's really fermented. Because it improves the flavor of the wine. In that when you have a lighter wine, as Rashi says over here, when you add in a sharper wine, it causes the fermentation to take place in a better way and produce a better wine in the end. So therefore, your adding of the wine is something that is positive to the situation, and therefore you can do this. Rashi over here makes statements that are argued on by other Rishonim. I'll just use the Rosh as an example, because the Rosh argues in all these cases as well, just like he did about the beginning of the Mishnah, which is, Rashi says, V'davka k'tani kasheh berach. Mishnah specifically states that you cannot mix the kasheh, the pungent wine, with the rach, with the soft wine. V'lo rach b'kasheh. But not the other way around. You're not allowed to put the softer wine into the kasheh. Because basakimo kasheh lo yareh ve'otarach. If you have really strong wine, you shouldn't put in the newer, softer wine. V'chein ein tzarich lomar chadashim bishanim davka. Says the same thing about the previous statement in the Mishnah. That you don't have to say that when you put new stuff in the old stuff, it's problematic. Aval yishanim bichadashim shapir dami. But if you put older stuff in with the newer stuff, that is okay. But Rashi says in all these cases that this Mishnah is dafka. When it says you're not allowed to mix new and the old, that's exactly what you can't do. You can't mix new with the old. But if you have new, you sold them new and now you're giving them old, you're allowed to do that because you're giving him the better stuff and you're mixing in better stuff. He's benefiting from it. Rashi says that's fine. The same thing with the wine over here. You're allowed to put the stronger wine into the, call it weaker wine, because that improves it. But the other way around, to put the weaker wine into the stronger wine, that would be deceptive because you're diluting the wine that is there. That's the way Rashi reads it. You can see the otiot of the Gra, who quotes the Rif and the Rosh, that disagree with Rashi. And in both these cases, they say that is not the case. The Rosh over here says that when it comes to new and old, that one may not, in either direction, change that which is there. It says, "Ve'en tarich lomar chadashim yishanim." The fish yishanim tovim la'achila yoter. But nearly, shimkanam yimenu chadashim, if he bought from him new stuff, shasur la'arev behem yishanim. You are not allowed to put old stuff in there, afilu shu tovim yoter la'achila, even though they're better quality. The fee, sejeh shekoneh chadashim, the one who's buying the new stuff, who wrote zeli yashnan. He wants to age them in his own silo. He wants to process them his way. V'yishanim ein ro'im lishanam. And when you give him old stuff, he doesn't have the ability to age them there. They'll actually go bad because you gave him the old stuff. So the Rosh says, unlike Rashi, he says, Rashi lo perish kein. He notes that Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi says, if you're upgrading, it's fine. If you're giving him better quality stuff, it's fine. If you're downgrading, it's problematic. The Rosh says it's problematic in both directions. Because even if he's buying the lower quality stuff, and then you put in higher quality, the reason he bought the lower quality, or the reason he bought the stuff that was yet to be aged, is because he wants to work with that which is here. He's not just being cheap, and he's not just paying for it. He wants to be able to process them himself. Therefore, when you put in the old stuff, you're actually causing him a problem. And over here, again, by the wine, he says, V'chol shekein rach b'kasheh shu mashbicho, v'fi shenot ne'mat kasheh b'rach, hu mashbiach hu mitkayem yoter. He says, if you put a little bit of pungent wine into the weaker wine, then that is fine because it lasts for longer. V'chol shekein rach b'kasheh. And certainly putting in the weaker wine into the stronger wine, mashbicho, it improves it. So here the Rosh says again, opposite of Rashi. Rashi over here says it's only allowed to put the sharper wine a little bit into the newer wine or the weaker wine. The other way around is not allowed. The Rosh says that both ways are beneficial and therefore you're allowed to do it in both directions. So again, the Rosh argues in each of these stages on Rashi. We just saw three stages in the Mishnah. In each stage of the Mishnah, the Rosh argues on Rashi's interpretation. Ein maravin shimrei yayin b'yayin, you're not allowed to mix in the dregs of the wine with the wine. We'll deal with this in the Gemara. The Gemara will explain what this means. Aval noten lo et shmarav, you're allowed to give him the dregs. Again, the Gemara will discuss these two lines in the Mishnah. Mi shenitarev mayim b'yayino, someone who mixes water into his wine, lo im karene b'chanut elim kein hodio, you're not allowed to sell it unless you identify it as diluted wine. People coming in think they're buying full, potent wine, not diluted wine. You put water in there, then you're, in a sense, tricking them into thinking they're buying wine when they're really buying something that is already diluted. Velola tagar, and you may not sell that to a merchant or a wholesaler. Afal pishodio, even if you tell him about it, she'enu elo ramotbo. He's buying that not because he's going to pass on the information. When you tell him that it's diluted, he's going to sell it as undiluted afterwards, because why would he be buying diluted? He could then just sell it on, and he's not going to tell the truth afterwards, especially since he's doing it himself. So you can't do it. You have to do it in a way that if you've diluted it, you're selling it and identifying it as diluted wine. You can't trust other people then to sell it with that identification mark, because they're more likely, either because they don't remember, they don't think about it, they try to ignore the fact that you told them, but they're going to sell it as real wine even though it's diluted. Makom shnagul atil mayim b'yayin yatilu. In places where the minhag is to dilute the wine, then you dilute the wine because everybody knows the wine that they're buying has that diluted quality to it. Hadakar notel mehei granot, noten otoch migura achat. A tagar, a wholesaler, can buy from five different individuals and then put it into one silo to store. Mehei gitot, you can buy from five wine presses, notoch pitum echad, and you can leave them in one barrel or one storage area. Uvaj lo yeh mitkaven larev. As long as he's not intentionally trying to cover up that he's dealing with different qualities. And that if he's taking lesser quality items or lower quality items and then mixing them in order to sell it as a higher quality item, then it's problematic. If he's simply taking produce from different fields that are of the same nature or same quality and mixing them together, that can be expected. A wholesaler is a consolidator of suppliers. So you can expect when he's supplying from me, he's not supplying from a single producer, he's supplying from multiple producers. But you do expect is that he has a consistent quality to that which he's supplying, and therefore he can't mix in different qualities and present to you as if he's giving you a single or good quality item. Tarabanan, ein tzarich lomar, which is found in our Mishnah, chadoshot mi'arba. If the new ones are four for a seller, which means they're cheap, vishanot mi'shalosh, and the older grain is three to the seller, which means that the newer ones are cheaper, the older ones are more expensive, dein ma'arvin. Over there you're not allowed to mix it. Ela afilu chadashot. Even if the new ones are mishalosh, are more expensive, vishanot mi'arba, and the older ones are cheaper, because they get four to the seller instead of three to the seller, ein ma'arvin. You are not allowed to mix them, ipnei she'adam rotzeh liyashnan, this is what the Rosh said before, because the person wants to age them himself. And so this idea that when you buy something, even if you're selling it something that is more expensive, and you could give them the finished product in the end, we don't allow you to do that. We don't allow you to change it because a person, when he's buying it, has a specific intent. And over here, his intent is that he wants to age them over time. The natural change in price is that if you get more quantity at the harvest, which is cheaper at the harvest, than it is after it's been dried out. Because the processing reduces the quantity. So therefore, when you mix it together, even though he's giving an improvement, the stuff's already aged, which means that he's selling it to him at the cheaper price. He's still not allowed to do that because this person bought the newer stuff because he wants to age it himself. If that's the case, you're really changing it. So this, again, is supportive of what the Rosh was saying before. Again, for Rashi, he's going to have to explain it that when the new stuff is me'arba and the yishanot me'shalosh, so it is cheaper to buy the new stuff and the yishanot are more expensive, you're not allowed to obviously put the chadash into the yashan, but Rashi says over here, even when the price is flipped, where the new stuff is more expensive than the old stuff, you still can't put in the new stuff into the mix. Because when a guy buys it, according to Rashi, he buys it because it was already aged. He's buying it because he doesn't want to have to go through the processing of the age. So Rashi has to explain the Gemara just the opposite over here, because Rashi thinks the problem is only in one direction. Only in one direction is that you're not allowed to mix the new with the old. But if you give him the old, that's not a problem. So Rashi says over here that the explanation is, even if the new is worth more than the old, you're not allowed to mix new in for him. According to the Rosh, the Gemara here is saying that both directions are problematic. Be'emet amru b'yayin etu l'arev, kashe barach v'mneshu mashbicho v'chulei. Amru l'azar, Adam Ra. So you could either read this Adam Ra, which is that Adas said, but the way Rashi explains it is, zot omeret. You can conclude from here. That's kamo ada, kamo hada. That this is what you would conclude from here. Kol be'emet amru alochai. Whenever the Mishnah uses the term emet, that is the alocha. Meaning that right away Rashi says over here, the fact that the Gemara gave the reason for the Be'et Amru shows you that this is a definitive statement or a definitive psak. And therefore, Be'emet means Alocha is like this and have no doubts about it. And that's what it means in the Mishnah. The Rambam goes ahead to say that anytime it says Be'emet means Alocha L'moshe Mitzinai. At Alocha L'moshe Mitzinai, the Rosh tempers that a little bit and says not literally Alocha L'moshe Mitzinai, but as if it is Alocha L'moshe Mitzinai and Alocha is like that. Amrav Nachman, uben agitot shano. You're only allowed to do this mixing when it is still at the presses. Meaning that not later on after the wine's already developed, but rather early on, right at the presses, if you mix them, then that will improve the flavor because the two wines will age together at that point and they will affect each other. Once the wines are already developed and then you mix them, that is problematic. Vayidna dekarmarve shalo ben agitot. What about today? We have that people are mixing it after the wine's already fully developed and fully matured, they're mixing the wines. Because it's well known. Everybody knows that it's a mix, and therefore they know that, and they're mochel on it, because when they buy it, they know it's a mix. And that's true maybe by the whiskeys as well, unless it says otherwise. The whiskey, if it doesn't say single malt on it, it means that the whiskey was assumed to have been mixed, and people know that that's the way that it's sold. The author of this position is Rabbi Acha de Tanya. Rabbi Acha matir b'davar nitam. Rabbi Acha says it's fine if the person can taste it. Meaning that Rabbi Acha says it's only a problem when it's deception. When the person can't discern the fact that this is the case. But over here, if you gave a person a taste of this wine, he would know right away that it was mixed wine, then it's not deception because it's clear. The flavor, or the change in flavor is clear here, and therefore Rabbi Acha believes, and we're going to see him come up again, that it's visible. Anything that is visible, tasteable, meaning that it's obvious that something was done here, that's not a problem, because people are going to be aware of the fact that it was done. The problem is when it's deception, when you're covering it up, and the person thinks he's buying one thing, is really ending up with another thing. Ve'imarvin shimrei yayin b'yayin, aval noten lo et shmarav. We talk about the dregs here. Vamar Resha Ein Me'arvin Klau. Doesn't the Resha of the Mishnah say you're not allowed to mix it at all? So what is this over here that you're allowed to mix the dregs in? V'chiteima Ma'inotein Lo Et Shmarav. You say, what does it mean? Give him the dregs. To come modile. That you inform him of that fact. Ha'amniktani Seifa. The latter half of the Mishnah says, Lo'im Karenu B'chanut Elim Kein Modio. Don't sell it in the store unless you identify it or make it clear to him. Below the tagar, afu pishim odiyah, you're not allowed to sell it to a wholesaler, even if you let him know. Michlau de reisha, afu gav de lamodile. That means that all the cases earlier in the Mishnah are talking about cases where there was no identification, no clear signage about what was going on here. And yet you're allowed to put in the shmarim. What does that mean? So I'm Rabbi Yehuda, hachi kamar. Ein me'arvin shmarim shel emesh b'shel yom. You're not allowed to mix yesterday's dregs with today's wine. V'lo shel yom, and not today's dregs b'shel emesh with yesterday's wine. Avonotein lo et shmarav. But you can put in the dregs that belong to that wine. Rashi says, you know, yesterday and today are just examples. It's not that they are dafka, that is lav dafka. But the ability to mix the dregs back in is only when it's the dregs that belong to that particular wine. Because the dregs that belong to that particular wine give the proper flavor and help it to ferment properly. If you put in dregs from another wine, they're going to cause a change in flavor and maybe even the wine to go bad. So you're permitted to have the dregs of that particular wine in there, but not the dregs from another wine. Tanya Nami Ochi, we have a brighter that supports this. Rashi says here, anything, when it says shofeh, is anything that's clear, and that it pours easily, that it's not viscous, but rather it moves from clay to clay in a very easy manner. So that's something that does not have dregs in it, because something without dregs is clear and easy to pour. So shofeh yayin lechaviro, hazeh lo yarev shel emesh b'shel yom, lo shel yom b'shel emesh. Should not mix in yesterday's with today's, and today's with yesterday's. But you're allowed to mix in yesterday's with yesterday's and today's with today's, meaning that it's okay to put the dregs in with the wine as long as they are the dregs that belong to that particular wine. And the assumption is that when someone buys the wine, he's not buying filtered wine. He's buying wine that includes dregs in it. If he's buying filtered wine, then you cannot add in the shmarim anymore. But if he's buying regular wine and he assumes there are going to be dregs in there, then you're allowed to put the dregs in because he bought it, assuming there would be dregs, as long as they are the dregs that belong to that wine. Rava had wine he purchased that came from the store. Mazge. He mixed it, he diluted it. Tame, he tasted it. Lava basim. It wasn't flavorful, he did not like this wine. Shadre the chanuta. He sent it back to the store to be sold. Don't we have in our Mishnah? Lola tagara for pisho dio. You're not allowed to give it to the wholesaler, even if you tell him that you've now mixed water in here. Rova diluted the wine. So even if you identify to the tagar that's the case, then it's still problematic. And over here, the chanuta is going to have that same problem. Because over here, Rova was the one who did the dilution. If he gives it to the storekeeper is not the one doing dilution. He's getting already diluted wine. And now you can cheat the customers. I'm laying masgadidi midiyadiya. My dilution is well known. So Rava's dilution was different. As the Bali Tosafot point out over here, Rava says any wine that is not diluted 3 parts to 1 is not considered to be wine. That is the dilution of Rava. Rava's dilution was 3 parts water to 1 part wine. The standard dilution was 2 parts water to 1 part wine. So when you see the wine or you taste the wine, you knew right away that it was Rava's dilution and not a regular dilution of wine. What the problem is when it's indiscernible. When it's not clear whether the wine is diluted or not, that's when it's problematic. Over here, Rava says, my wine, the taste is clear, and it's clearly identifiable as diluted wine. Therefore, nobody can cheat when they sell the wine because it's so obvious that it's diluted. B'chitema, what is he going to do? V'taifi u'michayle, that he's going to actually add in, the way Rashi has a different gears over here, Rashi has a gears of chimaiti chamra chayo. So you're going to bring raw wine, meaning that undiluted wine, and mix it in. So what's the storekeeper going to do? He's going to get Rava's diluted wine, which is obviously diluted, but then he'll pour more undiluted wine into it to bring the dilution down. Then it won't be discoverable, the dilution. So he says, he's going to sell it. He says, then you can never sell anything to anybody, because if you say that, what, he's going to cheat here, I gave him diluted wine, he's going to cheat by undiluting the wine, by putting in stronger wine. He says, any chanvani that you sell to, you can say, oh, he's going to pour water in it, he's going to do this, he's going to do that. You have to trust people up to a certain point. The problem is when you sell something that's already problematic and it's not clearly identifiable, there people will cheat with that. But we don't suspect people of cheating up front or doing things to cause the cheating. So if I give him fully diluted wine, we're not going to worry about him pouring in wine to undilute that wine. Makom shenatu la'atil mayim b'yayin yatilu, and places where they have a minhag to put it in, Tana lemechsa, the shlish, the revia, places that it's a half, places that it's a third, places that it's a quarter, Amrav, ubena gitot shanu, once again, Rav qualifies that the addition of the dilution has to be done at the presses, not later on. Meaning it's something that's a part of the wine fermenting in this manner as part of the production of the wine, not something that's done after the fact to dilute the wine, because that again is deceptive in nature. All right, next Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, lo yichalek chenvani klayot ve'egozim letinokot. A storekeeper may not distribute roasted items or nuts to the kids, mipnei shu margilan lavo etzlo, because then he causes them to come and do business with him rather than other people. He's using some sort of exogenous lure to bring in the kids, nothing to do with what he's selling, but rather he's bringing them in through his advertising. So Rabbi Yehuda considers this to be unfair advertising and marketing practices. Chamim matirim. Chamim says it's fine. We're going to see it in the Gemara because he can do the same thing. He's not preventing you from marketing in the same way. This is his marketing campaign. You can do the same marketing campaign. You can match him. Lo yifchot et ashar. Once again, seems that this is Rabbi Yehuda's statement as well, is that a person should not sell below market price, because then he's going to bring the whole market down when he lowers the price. Chamim mim, zachor letof. Why not? This guy's great. He is actually bringing the whole market price down, and therefore everybody's a beneficiary of his lowering of the prices. Competition is good for pricing. And if someone wants to compete by bringing the price down, that's good for everybody, because all the buyers then are going to benefit from that. I hear that Mishnah does not define about how much of a discount he wants to give. If he's selling at a loss, then it might be a problem. Again, depends why he's selling at a loss. If he's selling at a loss because he needs to liquidate, he needs to be out, maybe that's okay. If he's selling at a loss to put other people out of business, that is usually considered to be unfair business practices. So loss leader is a mechanism that's used today in order to market or advertise in that way. The Gemara here does not seem to address that issue. Lo yivor et agrisim, divrei abashol. A person should not clean the legumes. They shouldn't mill and clean the legumes that yivor from the word borer, to pick out the bad stuff from them, because abashol believes that the people will overpay for it. There's a certain amount of work involved in being borer. So if you sell it to him when it's in its husks or with the shells that are there, then a person pays a certain price. Once you've cleaned it, he's going to pay a higher price because you've already done the labor. What Abishol says is that people overestimate the value of that, and then therefore they pay too much for it. Chamim said he's not trying to cheat them. He's not doing anything that's not clear. People know how much it costs or the labor-intensive nature of picking it out. And they can pay as much as they want to not have to do it themselves. The real answer of why this is here is Modim, Shlo Yivor Me'al Pi Amigura. This again goes back to what we mentioned in the Rosh in the previous Mishnah, is that he shouldn't clean the stuff at the top of the silo. She'enu Elo Konev Et Ayin. Because over there he's trying to cheat the people or deceive the people. He shows the top as being clean and well picked over legumes, but underneath it, it's not. So he's selling it to them as already clean items when it's not really that way. The same thing as putting the good produce on top and the bad on the bottom. You can't deceive people by selling something that is not the case with what, which is below what they can see. Mifarkesim lo et adam, v'lo et beima, v'lo et kelim. Over here, it's not clear what the word mifarkes means. The Gemara will deal with it, but you can loosely translate it as, we don't fatten up or pretty up something before we sell it. Because again, that is a deceptive practice, and we'll speak about what those practices were. What is the reasoning by the Rabbanan that say that this marketing campaign is fine? The Amrar Le, Ana Mafligna Emgoze. I'm distributing nuts. V'ad Palik Shiski. You should distribute Shiski. Look in Rashi. Shiski is prunes. You can compete with me. You can do whatever you want. I'm not unfairly marketing. I'm just using a ploy. You can use the same ploy to differentiate yourself somehow. And you can market as well. It's a fair game. I'm not doing something that's unfair to you. So as opposed to the previous case where they say matir, it's okay for him to market this way, over here say it's good for him to do this. And it says, my time with the Rabbanan. What's the reason the Rabbanan? Mishum dekama marvach letara. Because he is benefiting all the purchasers, all the retailers here, because once he lowers the price, everybody will match his price. So over here, I think the Gemara is saying something that is very obvious, and that's why I said to you before, I think what the Gemara is saying is that you're allowed to do this if it's done in a manner that lowers the market price, but not with, I think, nefarious intentions to drive other people out of business, but you're selling even below your cost, because that's problematic. Over here, you're lowering the price, and there's going to be plenty of supply. If you do it in the other manner, you're going to drive supply out of the market, and then you're not actually benefiting the market, because this lower price will lead to a much higher price. Over here, he's taking the price down, and it's a sustained reduction in the price, which is beneficial to the whole market. Man chachamim. Who are the chachamim over here? The same Rabbi Acha that we met in the Brighton before. The Tanya Rabbi Acha matir b'devar nira. Before he said b'devar nitam. Something that's obviously tasted, you're allowed to do. Something that is visible, you're allowed to do. And that's what he's saying here. The prepared fruit, as you're calling it, is clearly visible what you did. A person has to make a determination as what they're willing to pay for a finished good versus the raw good. And we know from today that there's a premium for that. Meaning that even though the cost of processing or making the item from the raw state to the finished state is only so much, people will not just pay for that amount, they pay a premium to that because they don't have to undo it, undertake that work. They don't have to be bothered with that work. And therefore they pay a premium, and that's what the Chachamim are saying. It's obvious what you're paying for, and therefore if they're willing to pay a premium, that's their issue. Ein mefarkasim lo et adam lo et kelim. One cannot be mefarkes adam kelim, tarna banan. What does that mean? Ein misharvitin et abeima. You're not allowed to cause the animal's hair to stand up. So the way Rashi says it over here, lashon sharvit. Sharvit means like a staff, to have the hair stick up. Because it looks like it's fat. He's making it look much fatter. You cannot blow up the innards. Meaning if you're selling the kirbaim, you don't blow them up so they look bigger. You cannot soak the meat in water. That's both because it looks fatter and juicier, but it also makes it weigh more. So again, you're cheating in that way. My aim is sharvatim. What does that mean? Hachi targumu. Maya de chizra. That they feed him water that is mixed with subin, with like groats, or with bran, because that causes the stomach to expand, makes the animal look bigger, plus it causes his hair to stand up, and that all makes the animal look bigger when it's not really that way. Ziri amar Rav Kana, mizgafto. It means to comb the hair. Can't comb the animal's hair to, again, make it look like it is wider or bigger than it really is. Shmuel, shara lemirma tume lesarvela. One is allowed to put on, tumei is, as Rashi explains over here, chutei meshi, silk strings. The sarvala is a beged, a cloak of some sort. It seems to be that the edge or the hem of the item, they used to put a decorative thing around it of meshi. Shmuel says that's fine. Others say that they used to tie the strings together in knots with double knots or double strings, which has made it fancier or nicer. Rav Yehuda Shara Lekiskuse Karmei, he allowed you to wash these colored bigadim. Rashi says to wash them with mei subim in bran as well. Rabba Shaba Lemedak Tzardo, he was also allowed you to tie tightly a beged that was made out of canvas because it makes it look like the strings are thinner or better quality stitch. Rabba Shara Letzlume Gire, he allowed you to decorate arrows. To paint or decorate the arrows. Papa Shmuel Charlotte Slume Dikule. He allowed you to paint or decorate the decal, which are the palm trees, or I don't know if he's talking about palm branches, palm wood, or he's talking about the dates themselves. So now, all of these cases, the reason is because it's obvious. It's visible what is being done to the item. And even though it increases the value of the item, it's not something where you are deceiving in any way. Because you're not trying to stitch the silk and say the whole beged is silk. It's just the decorative part at the bottom, and everybody knows that. And same thing with all these items. These are well-known tactics that everybody is aware of. So Gemara says, don't we say you're not allowed to prepare items to make them look better for sale? So lokasha, this is what we said before. It's the difference between deception and simply printing something up. If something is new, and then you paint it, or you pretty it up, then you're not trying to cover up something that's below it, because it's clear that it's a new item, and you're just making it nice to make it worth more. But if it's old, and then you paint over it, that is deceptive. Because the reason you painted the picture or the design on it is to distract from the fact that this is not a good quality or new item. Pirkus da'adam mahi. What exactly is this pirkus of an individual? Kihadawa Avdo Sabo. There was this older Eved Kanani. The Azal Tsave the Reshe Ludikne. He colored his hair and his beard. He had gray in his hair and his beard. And in order to deceive or hide that, he put black coloring in there to make himself look younger. So the word pirkus is used in other places in Shas to mean to put on makeup or to decorate. And so that might be what's being described over here. Pirkus over here is where you decorate or you pretty up something in order to present it in a manner that deceives the buyer. And so that's the Pirkus over here. So Ata de Kamei de Rova, he came before Rova, Amar Le Zibnan, he says, buy me. I'm an Eved Kanani, I'll be helpful to you. Amar Le, Rova says back to him, you Aniim b'nei beitecha. He quotes the Mishnah from Avot that says the Aniim should be in your household. And Rava says, I have many Aniim that I feed and take care of my household, and they do the work that I need because they're living here. So their contribution is that they do the work. I don't need an Eved Kanani. Atzal the Kamei de Rav Papa bar Shmuel, he went to Rav Papa bar Shmuel Zavne, he bought him. Yom Echad, Amalei Ashkin Mayo, said, give me some water. Azal, Chivrei, the Reishe Ludikne. While he was dealing with the water, it got on his beard, it got on his hair, and it took away the coloring, and all of a sudden, he doesn't look so young anymore. He said, oh my gosh, Amalei Chazu Da'ana Kashish Mavuch.
And the Eved said to Rav Papa bar Shmuel, I am older than your father.
It was obviously a Mekach Taot, but now he has an Eved Kanani, who's much older, but he also might have thought that there was an issue of Hadar, that if it applies to non-Jews, this respect for elders, this person was an older individual that maybe can't utilize him in this way as an Eved Kanani because of his age. He's someone that needs a little bit of respect or has to be treated well. But obviously the bigger problem is that you're older than my father and I bought you as an Eved Kanani, who I thought was going to last for many years because you were younger. Kari Anafshe, Rav Papa Shmuel reads or says this pasuk about himself. Tzadik mitzara nechelatz. The tzadik is removed or saved from the pain. V'yavo acher tachtav. And someone else comes in his place. He's saying the tzadik, referring to Rava. Rava was saved from buying this misrepresented slave because he was a tzadik. And I, the acher, came in his place and ended up taking him instead. The pasuk really says, V'yavo rasha tachtav. And the evil one or the rasha will take his place, meaning that the evil one will be the one who gets the bad that should have gone to the tzaddik. Obviously, Rav Papa bar Shmuel doesn't want to call himself a rasha, so he mends the pasuk to read acher, but to use the idea behind the pasuk to describe himself that Rava was protected and I ended up with what Rava was protected from. I'm the one who ended up with that in the end. All right, Adronach HaZahav. With that, we end Perek HaZahav.
Okay, we're beginning now the parak of Ezu Neshech. Ezu Neshech is known to be one of the more difficult prakim in Shas. Similar to parak HaZahav, a lot of the difficulty doesn't stem from the Gemara itself, but rather differences in our conceptions of risk and time value of money versus those of the Gemara. In the modern era, we have an ability to, in a definitive way, to determine what is time value of money, and we use interest as the mechanism for articulating what the value of money is over time. We also use interest rates as a way to gauge risk, or to be repaid for risk. And therefore, we use interest not only as a mechanism for determining the value of money today, versus the value of money over time, but we also use it as a mechanism to assess the risk of default or the inability of repayment of the borrower in certain circumstances. The Gemara, first of all, does not recognize interest as being a mechanism of compensation or value in exchange for the risk undertaken by the lender. And number two, even though the Gemara in a number of places recognizes that there is a time value of money, for instance, in the Masech Ketubot, we saw that if a woman sells her ketubah, that the discount that the buyers will pay is based on the fact that there's optionality, as well as that there is a time gap between the payment for the ketubah and the receipt of the money later on. So Gemara clearly understands that concept, but doesn't see interest as a way to formulate it. And for that reason, our view sometimes of what the Gemara calls interest doesn't seem to be interest, but rather compensation for risk. And sometimes what we would otherwise call imputed interest, the Gemara calls that as derach mekach u'memkar, and doesn't view it as being a collection of interest. Those differences in conception really contribute a lot to some of the difficulty that there is in understanding the parak. I will try to point out when we reach those different scenarios and situations to explain those differences. Another key difference, which is actually manifest in some of the halachot that exist in the parak, but really is more about the time of the krah. The reason the psukim say that one may not lend with interest is because the borrowing envisioned by the Torah is really borrowing of money by individuals who are tremendously indignant, Some people who are living on the edge, they're borrowing money for their basic necessities. And the person lending them the money, in a sense, is a loan shark or charging usurious rates to this individual who is in desperate need. And the Torah wants to prevent the individual from taking advantage of this borrower who's in dire need and has necessities and is borrowing money for his basic necessities. And that's what the reasoning behind mention of the Shemitah Kesafim, as well as the Torah's restriction against collecting interest. Now, while we don't paskin like Rabbi Shimon, who says that we're darshin and timing to crawl, the reason behind the psukim, which would have normative impact on how we view the psukim, nevertheless, the Ramban and the Rambam, which I've quoted here before, say that there's an importance in understanding the reasons behind the laws of the Torah. And understanding those reasons, even though they don't have normative impact, should have an impact on our shkafa vis-a-vis these items. So first of all, it is manifest in the parak here, where the Gemara will differentiate between things that are done derech halva'a, which are done through a loan, versus things that are done derech mekach umemkar, which are done through a transactional nature. And the Gemara indicates that rebit min haTorah, the Torah prohibited rebit, is only derech halva'a. It's done in a manner as a loan or lending and a receipt of more in return from that lending. If the transaction is entered to it through derech umemkach umemkar, which we'll have many examples of both in this Mishnah as well as throughout the Perak, that is not necessarily rebit midoraita. It's rebit midrabanan, either because it's mechsek rebit or because it has too much profit for the lender. But we'll see through the Perak. And then there are exceptions to those rules, which we actually already discussed in Perak Zav, and we'll discuss again in this Perak, where if it's done derech mekach umemkar and it has some of those options, first, for instance, yatsa ashar, there's already a fixed market price for the item, or yeshlo, he has in possession already the item that he needs to return, then derech mekach umemkar with those conditions is considered to be okay. But already you see the chachamim are differentiating between a halva'a and mekach umemkar, a difference which in all likelihood stems from the nature of the restriction of the Torah about lending, that the lending is really an issue of lending and not transactional or commercial item. And for that reason, it seems to us in many ways ludicrous that if you are going to lend money to a business in order to expand, that you can't charge interest for that. Because again, the Torah didn't envision you lending money to an individual to buy a new apartment building, to invest in a business, and therefore it was not trying to restrict that type of transaction where it's really a business transaction, not a loan shark or usurious loan that is for someone who is lacking in basic necessities. So for that reason, even though it has no normative impact in terms of saying that interest charges are all right, it does have an impact on halacha with regards to heter iska. Now, even though heter iska is not really the topic of this perek, and we won't speak about it so much, the usage of a heter iska to circumvent the issue of interest by basically doing it through making it into a business partnership and a hitchayvut, we allow people to do this and may not even think that it's bidiavad, is because of the distinction that I made, that the Torah, in many senses, wasn't coming to make a sore business transactions or charging interest in those situations. It's really about people who are in desperate need for their basic necessities. And so for that reason, the Rishonim and Puskim are makil the Gabe Heter Iska and the usage of Heter Iska, not seeing it as a bidiavad, but rather as totally mutar and a fair way to deal with the situation, because that way we can keep the spirit of the halacha, which is the not charging interest in the situations where it's someone in desperate need, where it's really a matter of tzedakah, as we'll see in the psukim, rather than a loan, vis-a-vis other situations where people borrow because it makes sense from a tax standpoint, a business standpoint, a return on equity standpoint, and to separate those two issues out and allow a heter iska to be used in those situations to, yes, in a legal manner, circumvent the Torah's laws, but in a spirit of the law, not to go against what the Torah really says, because those weren't the cases, at least if you look at the psukim and Darshan Taimi Dekra, where the Torah really wanted to prohibit interest. And now, to begin the parak, we'll quote the psukim that actually deal with this. The first of psukim is found in Parshat Mishpatim, which is Im Keset Talveh Tami Et Ayini Imach. Here again is an indication that the loan has been given to someone who is impoverished, and if you lend money to someone who's impoverished, Lo Tia Lo Kinosheh, you should not be like a oppressor. We just learned this noshe with regards to the ona'a. Lo tisimun alav neshech. You may not place on him interest. The word neshech comes the word nashach, to bite. And because interest bites, as the Gemara will describe later on, it takes small bites and it slowly eats away at the person's ability to repay it, because it continues to accrue and get bigger and bigger the longer the person keeps the loan outstanding. So it's a bite vis-a-vis the borrower of the money. Then also in Vayikra Perek Chof Hei, which is another parshia where Shemitah Kesafim is found, and other issues with regards to dealing with people who have fallen on hard times, it says over there, V'chi yamuch achicha umata yado imach, a person falls on hard times, and now he comes to lean on you. V'exaktabo girvetoshav v'chayi imach. You have to help him out. You have to uplift him. Al tikach mito neshech v'tarbit. Don't take from him neshech and tarbit. Here's the other word used by the Torah, rebit. Interest, which is the modern-day Hebrew word for interest, is rebit. And that comes from the other word, bolt, to expand. And really, this is almost from the perspective of the lender. The lender expands or increases his money by lending to this individual. Once again here, the header to the parsha is that the person fell in hard times. So again, we're talking about lending to someone who's in a difficult predicament. So you may not take for him neshech v'tarbit. You may not lend your money b'neshech u'barbit lo titein ochlecha, and you may not give your food or for items b'marbit. The Gemara today will tell us that both neshech and marbit are synonymous, as well as the fact that ochel and kesef, it makes no difference. So whether the lent item is money or the lent item is merchandise or a product, if you get more back, that is the iser d'oraita of neshech or marbit. The Torah happens to use the word neshech by kesef and marbit by ochel, but the Gemara at the end of today's daf, really, and tomorrow's daf, will show us that it's synonymous and it doesn't really make a difference. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Asher Hotzeiti Etchem Me'eretz Mitzrayim, Hatei Lechem in Eretz Kanaan, Liot Lechem Le'elukim. And the last time it's found in Dvarim, Perek Chav Gimel, and Parshat Ki Teitzei, Lo Tashich Le'achicha, Neshech Kesef, Neshech Ochel, Neshech Kol Davar She'ishach. You may not lend with interest to your friend. That doesn't matter whether it's Kesef, Ochel, any item that you lend, you may not charge interest. V'nachri Tashich, U'lachicha Lo Tashich. And here there's a distinction made between lending with interest to a non-Jew versus lending to a Jew without interest. The reason being that we're in a club, and that's fine, meaning that we all agree as members of the club of this social structure that we're not going to charge each other interest. And therefore that's a part of the agreement or the social contract between us. But to outsiders, that is permitted to charge interest, because the people who are not inside of the group or inside the pact don't have the benefits of membership. So you have a benefit of being a member, is that other members will lend you money when you fall in difficult times without interest. This difference in halacha actually makes the Jews become the money lenders throughout the Middle Ages, where the church restricted the lending of money for interest, which are known as usury laws. And therefore, the Jews were always the money lenders that landed them in a lot of trouble in many situations, aside from the fact that most of the masses that were borrowing from them were in difficult circumstances because of the rulers, but their ire really was focused towards the Jews, who were the ones who were lending the money and asking for more back. So these are the three different places in the Torah where it speaks about neshech and tarbit, about charging interest and the restriction against charging interest. Here the Mishnah begins, and the Mishnah makes a distinction here between ribit d'oraita, ribit min haTorah, versus ribit min derabanan. The Mishnah, as we'll see in the Gemara, uses neshech to describe ribit midoraita, interest midoraita, and uses tarbit to describe interest that is charged, that it's only a violation midorabanan. And the Gemara will note that on a Torah level, there is no such distinction, but this is the way that the Chachamim used in order to express that difference between an iser doraita and an iser derabanan. Therefore, the Mishnah begins, ezu neshech. Bezu tarbit. What is considered to be neshech, meaning something that's asur min haTorah? Bezu tarbit, what is considered to be something that's asur min haRabbanan? Ezu neshech, a restricted charging of interest min haTorah, is hamal ve'sela behei dinarim. Someone who lends out a sela that is worth 4 dinar and expects 5 dinarim in return. Sa'taim chitim b'shalosh. Or whether he lends out 2 sa'ah of wheat with the expectation that the person will return him 3 sa'ah of wheat. So whether it's money, or whether it's a product or merchandise, either way, if you lend and expect to receive more back in return, that is considered to be the charging of interest. Asur, that is restricted, mipnei shehu noshech. Because in this case, he is charging interest, which is asur midudoraita. Vezu darbit, what is interest or charging interest, which is asur midurabanan? Hamarbeh bepeirot. Someone who is increasing in peirot. Now, the word peirot is used here in a loose way, but here, using or playing on the word marbit, it's saying that this person is increasing what they get back, even though, again, it may not be done in a manner that is a loan or makes it obvious that they are receiving interest. Ketzat, what is an example of that? Lekach emenu chitim bedinar zahav hakur. He purchases from him wheat at a dinar zahav per kur. A dinar zahav is worth 25 dinare kesef. So he's buying it from him at the rate of 25 dinar kesef per kur. V'chein ashar. And that is the market price at the time that he agrees to this. So he's forwarding him money for future delivery of chita. And the price that they're doing is based on the current market price, which is 25 dinare kesef per kur. That is totally allowed and permitted because there is a market or clear market price out there. The individual who you're giving the money to can go out to the market right away, buy whatever it is, and supply it to you immediately. If he chooses to wait and supply from that which he grows or that which he has, that's his choice. But that is not something where it's considered to be interest because it's mekach u'memkar. It's done in a manner which is transactional in nature. Plus, it is done when there's already a readily available market price that's there. And that's what I said to you before. In that manner, it is permitted. Amdu chitim bilamid dinarim. Then the price of chita goes up to 30 dinare kesef for a kur. So it used to be 25, now it's 30. So amar lo tenli chitai. He says, please deliver me my chita. Because shani rotze lemochran. I want to sell them now because I paid 25, but now I can garner 30 in the market. And again, all of this is mutar and totally permitted because it was done in a manner that was, again, commercial, transactional, when there was a well-known market price. And I want to sell them now to make my profit, and to then purchase wine with them. Amarlo, harei chiteich asiyot olai b'shloshim. I accept the fact now that I owe you chita that is at 30 dinar kesef. So now I'm making it into a 30 dinar obligation to you, because I'm not delivering you the wheat. And instead, I will deliver you the wine. You wanted to go buy wine with that 30 dinar. I'll now give you the equivalent value of wine for 38 dinar a kesef. So he's accepting, basically he's pushing the transaction out and saying, yes, you bought wheat from me originally. The price of wheat has gone up. So now I'm going to give you that higher value, but I'm going to deliver you that higher value now in wine instead of wheat. V'yayin ein lo. And he doesn't have any wine in his possession now. And as Rashi notes over here, even though there's a readily available market price for wine at the time, it's restricted. Again, this would seem to be fine because it's the same as the transaction that happened before with the wheat. He's buying forward wine like he bought forward wheat when there's a readily known market price. So the Gemara will discuss what exactly the problem is with this scenario. But this is ribit midrabanan, again, because it's not done derech halva'ah. It's not done in a manner of a loan, but rather as a transactional nature, which makes it into a ribit derabanan. Gemara says, Midushovik the ribit doraita, become a faresh derabanan. The fact that the Mishnah does not explain two cases of doraita, one case of doraita of neshech, and one case of doraita of marbit, and instead, kamefarish and rabbanan explains examples of ribit midrabanan under the category of tarbit, michlau de oraita. From that you would infer at a Torah level, the neshech v'tarbit chada milti. The neshech and tarbit are synonymous. V'ha'akrai k'tive. But the psukim seem to separate between them. Because it says neshech kesef v'ribit ochel. It uses neshech with regards to money. And it uses marbit with regards to ochel. And that's the pasuk. V'yikret kas b'cha lo titen lo b'neshech u'b'marbit lo titen ochlecha. So there seems to be a distinction in the Torah. Whether it's a distinction in the object that's being loaned, whether it's kesef versus ochel, or in the usage of the verb, which is neshech and tarbit. So why isn't there such a distinction? V'tizbara, you really think that there is a difference? T'ikan neshech below tarbit, v'tarbit below neshech, that there could be such a thing? And now the Gemara is going on to demonstrate that there isn't a difference. Now, the understanding of the Gemara now is neshech is to be bidden, and tarbit is to increase. So it's the perspective of the two parties here. The borrower is the one who's suffering the neshech, the bite. And the marbit, the increase in wealth, is what the lender is gaining. And so what the Gemara is going to show is that these items, quote unquote, are synonymous because in any instance where the lender is benefiting, the borrower is the one being bidden is losing. And if the borrower is losing, then that gain is going to the lender. And therefore, there's always going to be neshech where there's marbit, or there's always going to be marbit where there is neshech. That's what the Gemara wants to demonstrate here. Neshech bitlo tarbit echidami. How can you have a case where the borrower is suffering, whereas the individual, the lender, is not suffering at all? Idos ve mea b'meya v'esrim. He lent them 100, and he's getting back 120. Mi kara, in the beginning when he lent them the money, kaima meya bedanka, then it was 100 for a danka. The word danka means 1/6. Over here, Rashi describes 1/6 being 1/6 of a dinar kesef. Since there are 6 ma'ah in a dinar kesef, he says that it is 1 ma'ah. And the meya is prutot, 100 prutot for a ma'ah kesef. In a minute, we'll go back and discuss why that's very problematic. But let's just work with Rashi's assumption right now. So he says that a ma'ah is worth 100 prutot at this point. So when he lent them the money, he lent them a danka, he lent them this ma'ah, kesef, when it was worth 100 prutot. Ulusof kaima me'esrim bedanka. In the end, the ma'ah kesef, the currency, is now worth 120 prutot, which from the previous parak we know that the ma'ah becomes the static currency, and the prutot are the merchandise. So when he originally lent him a ma'a kesef, it was worth, or you could purchase with that, 100 prutot. Now afterwards, when he's repaying him, the ma'a kesef is worth more now. It's appreciated in value, and now you can buy 120 prutot with it. So neshech ika, there is neshech, the borrower's losing out, the kanochitle, the kashakamine, mide, de lo yoiv, because he's losing out. He's got a loss here because he has to give back more than he got. He got 100 prutot, and now he's giving back 120 prutot. Vitarbit leka, but from the lender's standpoint, there's no change. Delet le ravcho. He has no profit over here. The danka osve. He lent him a ma'a kesef. Bedanka gashokomine. And he's taking back a ma'a kesef. So he's getting back the same coin that he gave. He's giving back. Even though the person who borrowed from him now to buy that coin has to pay more for the coin. Gemara says, wait a minute. Sof. If you look at this from a bigger picture. Ibatar mikar azlit. If we go by the time of the loan, hari neshech, vari tarbit, then there is neshech and there is tarbit, because the borrower has to pay back 120 instead of 100, and the recipient is getting back 120 instead of 100. Id debatar b'sof azlat, if you go after the repayment of the loan at that point in time, lo neshech ika v'lo tarbit ika, there is no deficit to the borrower because he borrowed a ma'ah, he's returning a ma'ah. And there's no benefit to the lender because of the same thing. You got a ma'ah back. So over here, the ma'ah or the currency is the same ma'ah. The fact that certain items have moved in price vis-a-vis the static currency, that's not the problem both of the borrower or the lender, because either you look at the coin as being a ma'ah to a ma'ah and that's all he got, or you have to look at it that he's really paying more. If he's paying more, then the person who's receiving is also a beneficiary. So you have to look at it at any point in time. If you look at it from the point of time in the beginning, what he's repaying now is in excess of what he got. If you look at it at the time of repayment, then he's giving back exactly what he got because he's giving back a ma'ah kesef. He's handing him a ma'ah kesef, even though it cost him more to buy it. But you see that the two come in tandem, in that you can't separate between the borrower's loss and the benefit to the lender. You can't say, oh, one of them is losing out, the other one is not gaining, because you have to take the same perspective of the way that you look at it. Whichever perspective, if the borrower is losing, then the lender is gaining, and vice versa. If the borrower is not losing, then the lender is not gaining either. V'tu, tarbit b'lo neshech, heichidami. And what is the case of tarbit, where the lender is gaining, but the borrower is not losing? Idos if meya b'meya. If he lent out 100 for 100, he lent them 100 prutot and expects 100 prutot back. Mikara keima meya b'danko. Originally, you got 100 prutot for 1 ma'ah, meaning a danka, 1/6 of a dinar, uvlesof, mea b'chumsha. And in the end, when he gave him back 100 prutot, where we're worth 1/5 of a dinar kesef, which means that now he's getting back more than 1/6 of a dinar. He's getting back now 1/5 of a dinar. So his ma'ah kesef is worth more now. So again, the Gemara says, ibatar mi'ikar azlat, if you go by the origination of the loan, lo neshech ika v'lo tarbit ika. There's no loss to the borrower and no gain to the lender, because he lent out a ma'ah and he got back a ma'ah, and the person borrowed a ma'ah and gave him back a ma'ah. Ibatar sof azlat, if you look at it at the time of repayment, then the individual has to repay him, now has to expend 100 prutot, which buys a ma kesef, which is worth now one-fifth of a dinar, which is more valuable. So he's giving back an item that's more valuable than he borrowed. They're a harei tarbit. That means that the lender is benefiting the same way that the borrower is losing out in that situation. So again, you can't separate the items of the borrower's loss from the lender's gain. El amar Rava, iata motzei lo neshech v'lo tarbit, v'lo tarbit v'lo neshech. So Rava states what the Gemara's conclusion is, that tarbit and neshech go hand in hand. They're inseparable items. That if the borrower is losing, the lender is gaining. If the lender is gaining, the borrower is losing. Lo chilkana katuv. So then why did the Torah separate and use two different verbs? To tell you that you violate two restrictions. The Torah wants to emphasize that this is problematic. And therefore, it gives you two lavim for the same violation. The Baal HaTosafot Tosafot say over here, the reason it didn't use the same verb is that it's a nicer literary style, that if you're going to repeat something, you don't repeat it with the exact same word, but use a different word to say the same thing again. And so even though the words are synonymous, it's a way to express the same lav in different words. And that's the reason the Torah switches between neshech and tarbit, which will, again, continue with the Gemara tomorrow in describing how the Gemara sees neshech and tarbit being expressed both by kesef and by ochel, both by the lender and the borrower, that the restriction exists across the board and these words don't indicate any differentiation in the violation of the restriction. Now, even though the truth is that you can come up with a case where there is a separation between neshech and tarbit, in a case of ze choser v'ze lo nene, in a case where a person is living in the property of the lender and not paying him rent, even though he normally would rent it out, but, and ze lo nene, because this is not a guy that normally would rent out such a place. So there are cases where you can come up with these situations, but it doesn't seem likely that the Torah's case was speaking about some far-fetched or unusual circumstance like that. And therefore, the Gemara doesn't bring that as an example. The Gemara brings more commonplace examples where you can't separate between the item. Now, to go back to what I discussed before, that Rashi's explanation of the Gemara is very difficult, is because Rashi says that the 1/6 of the danka here is 1/6 of a dinar kesef, because a dinar kesef is changed into 6 ma'a. And so therefore, the danka here is really 1 ma'a. The problem with that is that a ma'a is equal to 2 pundion, and 1 pundion is equal to 2 isar. In essence, a ma'a is equal to 4 isar. We learned this back in Perek HaZahav. And each isar, we know from the Mishnah and Kiddushin, is worth 8 prutot. If you take 4 times 8, that's 32 prutot. And that means that a ma'a kesef should equal 32 prutot. And in our Mishnah, speaking about a case where it's equal to 100 prutot, according to Rashi. And that seems to be way off. It's one thing if it's off by a little bit, or there's a small change in the pricing. We saw that in the Gemara in Kiddushin, that it could be 6 prutot to an Isar, so then it would only be 24 to a Ma'ah, instead of 32. So you have fluctuations like that, but to suggest that the fluctuations between 32 and 100 seems to be way too wide. And for that reason, the Baal HaTosafot reject Rashi's understanding, but rather promote the understanding of the Rivan, who says the 1/6 over here is either 1/6 of a maneh. 1/6 of a maneh is 100 dinare kesef, and 1/6 of a maneh equals 16 dinare kesef, which would get you to 6 times 16. As we said before, the ma'ah is 6 of a dinare kesef, which would get you to 96 ma'ot inside of that calculation. So if you took 1/6 of a maneh, which is a danka, is 1/6. If you took 1/6 of 100 dinare kesef, then you would end up with 100 ma'a. Now even again, here, it's not exact. It's off by a little bit, but that little remainder is palatable in terms of a change. And so as Tosfot says, that 1/6 of 100 dinare kesef is equal to 4 sela plus 4 ma'a. 4 sela, each sela is worth 4 dinar, which is 16 dinar. So 1/6 of 100 dinare kesef is 16 dinar, with a residual of 4. And so that 4 is the additional 4 ma'ah you need to get to 100. Because if you take 16 dinare kesef, multiply it by 6, which is the number of ma'ah in a dinar, you get 96 ma'ah. So this 1/6 of a maneh of 100 dinare kesef yields you 100 ma'ah. Or he suggests that it's 1/6 of a dinar zahav. A dinar zahav, as we know before, is equal, and the Mishnah mentions here, is worth 25 dinar kesef. So 1/6 of a dinar zahav is 1/6 of 25 dinar kesef, which is the equivalent of 4 dinar kesef with a remainder of 1 ma'ah, which equals 25 ma'ah, because 4 dinar times 1 dinar equals 6 ma'ah is 24 ma'ah, plus the residual of 1 ma'ah is 25 ma'ah, and 25 ma'ah equal 100 isarim. Because as we said before, each ma has 2 pundion, and each pundion has 2 isar.
So the way the Rivan explains it is that either we're speaking about 1/6 of a maneh, which means 100 dinari kesef, and that yields you 100 ma kesef, or we're talking about 1/6 of a dinar zahav, which yields you 100 isarim. And in that way, he gets to a ratio that is much more sensible than the ratio that Rashi is explaining. The idea or the concept is the same, it's just that the translation of the currency, according to Rashi, seems far-fetched, and therefore the Rivan is presenting translations of currency, which the conversion rates make more sense and are much closer to the reality of what we've seen in the Gemara until now. Okay, with that, we're going to end here, 3 lines from the bottom of Samuch Amud Bet.